with Stuart Pink and Mark Searby.
Film reviews and movie news.
Yes, it is. It's film reviews and movie news with me, Stuart Pink, and fresh out of the workshop and ready to be a real boy, it's Mark Searby.
As some people would say, I've always been a real boy, but
I've heard. Yeah.
It's an odd concept. I'm all right, thanks. I'm all right. It's an odd concept, isn't it, when you think about it?
It is really, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Imagine if we were all born puppets and then became real boys.
Yeah, that's blown my mind a little bit now.
Maybe that's what really happens.
I can't believe you brought that up already. Brought that up and already it's blown my mind. Oh, I'm going to be thinking about that for ages now.
Dark and sinister start. Anyway,
it is. But, you know, listen, we're talking about this. We're talking about Pinocchio because there is a new Pinocchio movie. Now, you and I had a good joke, laugh, and actually we gave a good review to Pinocchio, the previous film. What was it, 2019? I think it came out.
Doesn't feel like that long ago. Yeah,
it doesn't feel like that long ago, but I'm sure it was 2019. I have to double check on that. And it was like the adult version of Pinocchio, not like that, for anybody who's, you know, disgusted with mine. But it was
not for the kids, was it?
No. It wasn't for the kids. It was more in keeping with the source novel than Walt Disney's version. So we've got that. Obviously, we've got the original Pinocchio as well, movie from Disney. And now we've got a new version of Pinocchio from Disney, basically. And the thing with this is, Disney have got this thing now. They've got it and they're running with it and we're not going to stop them, unfortunately. But over the past 5, 6, 7 years, they have basically been taking their old classic animation films and turning them into modern day live action films. So basically money for old rope, I think.
Pretty much, isn't it? Yeah. It's but it's sort of not. Yeah.
Hey, listen, come and see a real person play the cartoon version that you grew up loving. Okay. Yeah. So this is a new version of Pinocchio. It's a live action animation hybrid from Robert Zemeckis, the guy who gave us Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Oh yeah, okay.
Yeah, and you know, Back to the Future as well, and loads of other movies as well.
Nice.
I mentioned Roger Rabbit because obviously that's part live action, that's part animation. So you kind of think,
clever.
And let's be honest, it's a high watermark, isn't it?
It's like, I feel like the first sort of one, but they had a little bit of blend, wasn't it, between.
And it works.
Live action and cartoon.
And it still works. It's still funny to this day.
I think the
reason we talk about Roger Rabbit is because this is nowhere near as good as Roger and Friends. It's just this new version of Pinocchio is just not a good film. The filmmakers, as I said, stick into their own Walt Disney version of the classic story rather than going back to the source novel. We will come to that in December, where Guillermo del Toro has made his own version of Pinocchio. So yes, that's right, two films coming this year of Pinocchio, but Guillermo del Toro's is in December. It's based on the source novel, whereas this is based on the Walt Disney animation.
Okay. Now they're going to be very different then.
It's going to be very different. Yes. So now Robert Zemeckis has tweaked a few small points along the way, but nothing, you know, he hasn't changed the whole story that most of us know. The problem is that with this film, because it hasn't changed that much, it does feel very ordinary. You know, it doesn't have enough to it to even think that it compares or even betters the original animation movie from 1940. All the beats of the story that this film hits, I felt were very lackluster, had no real emotion behind them at all. I mean, I never warmed to Pinocchio. I never warmed to Geppetto. I never warmed to Jiminy Cricket. I mean, truth be told, the only character I actually enjoyed was the wily fox called Honest John. And that's because he was entertaining and he was fun and he was slightly dangerous as well. The rest of the cast was so nondescript. And that's saying something, as there is hardly any cast in this film at all. It's a very minimal cast movie. You know, even if you take out the CGI characters, there's hardly anybody in it. That's the weird thing. But even, I don't want to say even weirder, but unfortunately, the main thing that really got me with this is the CGI in this. I was watching it and I was like, it feels like it's about three different animation houses with their own style that haven't been told you need to follow this style that Zemeckis wants to do. And instead they've gone, we will do Wile E. Fox like this, and we will do Pinocchio like that. And it's all weird. You know, they're not working to the main style of the movie. So Honest John and his sidekick, I think, look brilliant. There's loads of detail on them. You can see the hairs ruffling and the medallions and whatever else. And it's really good. They are genuine standouts in this movie. But then at the opposite end of the scale, you have the lead character himself, Pinocchio, as a sort of bland, flat, muted animation. It's so lifeless.
Does it like an odd, seeing the trailer, it doesn't look quite right.
Exactly. Do you know what it looks like? I'll tell you what Pinocchio looks like. Pinocchio's facial structure and style, and certainly the eyes, reminded me of how they animated the humans in the Polar Express.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I suppose so.
Which is another Robert Zemeckis movie as well. Yeah. But the problem is, the way that they animated them in the Polar Express, it made them look like zombies.
But then if they're all like that, that's fine. But to have one character like that and then next to Jiminy Cricket, who looks very different.
Yes. But once again, this is strange. The thing. Mm. You have Pinocchio, who looks like a wooden sort of walking, talking zombie. Then you have Jiminy Cricket, who looks about right for a Walt Disney animation movie. And then you have Honest John, who shouldn't really be in a Walt Disney movie because that animation is so much better than everything else. You know, it should have been in like a Ghibli movie or a Laika movie or something else like that. I just think on the whole, the animation of this movie is so below par for modern feature films that it is just so nondescript. But therein lies the problem, is that I think this film is so below par anyway. It's not interesting. It's not funny. It's not nice to look at. I mean, even Tom Hanks, who once again is doing a really weird accent. I couldn't quite place it where it was from. I mean, I think it was meant to be Dutch, but I don't know. But even Tom Hanks can't save this film. I know.
That tells you how bad
this movie is. I just think this is another in a long line. It's another in a long line of Disney live action versions of classic animations that fails and fails spectacularly as well. That's the thing with this.
Big question. Do you think any of the live remakes have worked or improved on the original? I feel like every time they do it, it just disappoints, doesn't it?
Okay, right. So Jungle Book is great.
Okay. Yeah, that was all right.
Absolutely. Oh, that's a good question. I think there's probably been a couple in the past. Dumbo, I liked. I thought that was very good. But I think that was more to do with the fact that it was a Tim Burton movie and he'd got Michael Keaton and Danny DeVito in it. So it was like an unofficial Batman Returns. Dumbo, I liked. I'm trying to think what else now that they rehashed. Well, 101 Dalmatians, obviously really, really old, but I've got a soft spot for it. There's been far too many. You know, I mean, Aladdin,
clearly
obviously.
Clearly a bit of a project, isn't it, to remake all of these old classics, because they're getting through all of them. But I just wonder if they're just destroying them.
They've got the copyright for them already, you see, so they don't pay anybody else. Are they destroying them? The answer there is no, they're not, because you've still got the original. That's the good thing about it. So you still have the original. So, you know, it's like when we review a remake of a horror movie and it's absolutely terrible. It's fine because the original is still there. You can go and watch the original. It's just unfortunate that there's a certain thing that Disney go, right, well, what are we remaking next? You know, I don't know if it's being filmed now or if they're still trying to get it off the ground, but they're trying to do a Little Mermaid live action as well.
Oh, wow. How are they going to recruit the mermaids? They're very difficult to find.
Well, I don't know. This is the thing. I have no idea. Are they going to go down South End and see
if Peter Andre going to be in it? This is the question.
Exactly. This is the thing. So I don't know. So, I mean, to me, the Jungle Book, Dumbo, maybe a couple of others have been anomalies in what has been a very poor and shoddy idea from Disney of doing these live action remakes of classic animation.
Well, at least I'm glad they didn't say it was a news story, because otherwise they would have had a growing nose at the end of it.
Could you imagine if they said, yes, it's an all new story? No, it's not. It's the same story. Your nose is growing. Right. I see.
So this is out on...
This is exclusively on Disney Plus. It's streaming on Disney Plus from now, basically.
Nice. What else you got for us, Mark?
So on DVD and Blu-ray, and also on Sky Documentaries as well, is a documentary called The Princess. And it is looking back at the life and death of Princess Diana using archival footage.
Oh, okay.
Right. So obviously, documentary about Princess Diana, it's a hot topic. That's the thing. It's never not been
a hot topic,
is it? Exactly. But the question now is, how do you form a documentary that has been done so many times? And we had this same question come to us when we reviewed the documentary about the Queen earlier this year, didn't we?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. They did a thing, didn't they?
Look, how do you do it? And that one, Elizabeth, I can't remember what it was, something in parts, or something, I can't remember, decided to change it up. This one is very much a linear documentary. And I don't think it does anything new of note. There's no shocking revelations that we didn't already know. It starts when Charles and Diana fell in love and then moves through their life together and spends a lot longer on the divorce. And then obviously, you know, the ending. There are a couple of bits that did stick out for me in the documentary, because it is easy to forget in this modern era, you know, in the celebrity driven age that we now live in, with everybody online, Diana was really one of the first worldwide celebrities that everybody was aware of and just about everybody loved because of her public persona and how she came across in the press.
I mean, probably for modern times, it's difficult to kind of put it in context with social media and everything. Way before all that. So,
yeah, absolutely. That's the thing. The only way you would know about what this person was doing was through the news. That was it. There was nothing else. There's a really good line in the documentary about how Diana had overtaken Charles in being the one everybody wanted to meet and have photos of. And basically the press couldn't give away their photos of Charles at any point. It was all about Diana. You know, she was everything to everybody. That's the thing, you know?
Yeah.
And also, I tell you what came out of this is she'd got quite a mischievous smile. I mean, there's bits in this documentary where you just see the smile just drop in a little bit. And I thought, you know what? I bet any money she loved a good joke, and I bet she was full of sarcasm as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just came across like that in the documentary. That's
nice. That's a good sign. You get a bit of a personality through.
Yeah, you do. But I think also that probably plays into why she always felt she was never on the inside of the royal family, which is in this documentary. You know, she says that in this documentary with some of the footage, you know, she never felt like she got into the inner circle. The documentary does this weird thing where it tries to link Diana's ups and downs with the mood of the nation. It's a bit flimsy. I don't think it needed to be included. I mean, as we said, the Elizabeth documentary, A Portrait in Parts, that's what it was called, did that as well. And it did it very well.
Mm.
This one, I don't think it did it that well, to be honest with you.
Okay.
So I think, you know, the documentary, it's nothing new. It doesn't really give us anything new in terms of Diana's legacy. I think it is a perfectly serviceable documentary. But what I came away from this documentary thinking is, hang on a second, what we've seen in this documentary is kind of happening again with Meghan and Harry. The main takeaway from this documentary I had is that history is sort of repeating itself a bit with the next generation. And it does at times feel genuinely prophetic, you know, that it's something that we don't want to be reminded of, but actually we need to be reminded of that maybe we, the media needs to be held to account more for certain things. And I think as much as this is a documentary called The Princess about Diana, you could possibly make a case for this is a documentary about media and the obsession that the media creates. But the problem is that the documentary doesn't go that deep into the media. It doesn't go that deep into Diana's story either. So as I said, you know, look, it's a good doc, but it's just a good doc on ultimately what was an incredible woman.
Okay. So you didn't feel like you learned anything new, but at the same time, it captured all of it together.
No, I don't feel like I learned anything new. There was some footage in there that I'd never seen before. So, you know, that was kind of interesting, but I didn't come away going, wow, what a revelation. It was just, as I said, very serviceable. That was it. Hmm. But, you know, the thing is, this documentary came with such fanfare because it played at Sundance Film Festival earlier this year. And was like, people were like, oh, amazing, 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 fantastic. And then it played at Sundance London. And everybody who went to see it kind of went, ah, so what? And I think that shows you the differences between, you know, ourselves on this side of the pond
compared
the other people, and how they will take a certain type of documentary compared to how we will. It was kind of interesting to see that side of it. And once again, that comes back to the media angle of it as well. You know, the media are blowing this up. It's a huge, it's a massive, massive, massive. And then it comes down and you actually see it and you go, oh, well, I'm not sure what you were talking about, really.
Not sure it was all that huge.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So in a way, then, quite an important watch then for anyone in media or looking to, or at least doing media studies, perhaps.
Maybe media studies. There are points in this that I think would come across well in a media studies course, but it does feel like it's never going beyond the surface of it. That's the issue.
Mm. So The Princess, where is it on?
So DVD, Blu-ray, and it's also on Sky Documentaries as well.
Cool. And what you got for us on the podcast?
So we've got a film called Crimes of the Future. Now, at this point, humans adapt to a synthetic environment with new transformations and mutations. With his partner, Caprice, Sol Tensa, a celebrity performance artist, publicly shows the metamorphosis of his organs in an avant-garde performance.
Whoa. Okay.
That Blimey. Is wild. Like, that synopsis is wild. You know, it just conjures up so many ideas and thoughts. And I mean, goodness knows what. Now, if I tell you this is the latest film from David Cronenberg, the man who gave us The Fly, and Scanners, and Videodrome, and the infamous Crash movie as well, you can see all of a sudden why that synopsis starts to play into it. Because, you know, David Cronenberg has always been a master of doing what is termed body horror movies, basically. You know, he's dealt with stuff that have dealt with the body. So you can see it, you know, here he's dealing with this person who's, you know, he's showing off his organs and whatever else. The weird thing about this movie is that this is a stance against body horror. It's a movie that looks at the very nature of humans chemically, in one form or another, changing their body in order to suit what society thinks they should look like. I mean, to me, it kind of represented a call to arms to fight back against plastic surgery. You know, it's a movie that wants you to be repulsed by what these people are doing to their bodies. And then David Cronenberg is basically saying, but this is no different to what many people around the world do for nothing more than vanity. I mean, it's terrific filmmaking in that regard.
Clever. Yeah,
it is. It is. Sol Tensa is played by Viggo Mortensen. He is. Sol Tensa is this. Yes, exactly. Aragorn. But also, you know, he's worked with Cronenberg in the past. So this guy is an iconic celebrity that people worship, but they don't actually know what he really is like. So he's got this massive cloak and he walks around like he's hovering. He's like this eerie figure. Then you have Kristen Stewart as Timlin, who is a bureaucrat that's really buttoned down. She's very straight talking, but really nervous as well, because she is haunted and fascinated by what Sol Tensa is doing. I mean, it's such a different performance from Kristen Stewart. And it's one that is so difficult to imagine her ever doing. You know, if somebody had said to me, Kristen Stewart's going to play this, I'd be like, I don't think so. I can't imagine her even doing it. But she's great at this. You know, I mean, I think now she is taking on all of these chances of doing different.
Yeah, she's been doing a variety of things.
She has. Lately, she has. You know, I mean, you think about her performances as Diana. I mean, reverting back to obviously the princess.
Yeah.
In Spencer, very different performance. You know, gone are the Twilight days, and now she's making completely different movies. She's very good in this. Her chemistry with Lea Seydoux's character, Caprice, is strangely magnetic. Like, you're never really sure what they're up to or what they might do next, but you're obsessed with finding out. That's the thing about it. But the question is, obviously, this is a David Cronenberg movie. So I guess the question is it grotesque like Scanners or Videodrome? And I guess on some level it is, but it's not a straight horror movie. You know, this is a classic Cronenberg psychological horror with occasional splashes of genuine grossness. I think it probably operates better in science fiction than horror. But even if I say it's a science fiction movie, it's still going to make your skin crawl at times. It's new, but old David Cronenberg. It's one of the sharpest takedowns on celebrities and staying youthful as well. It's just a wild movie. It's just a movie that isn't interested in playing by the rules.
Nice. And that's a refreshing thing sometimes, isn't it?
It is. Well, we talk about this. We talk about this, don't we? We say, you know, listen, give the filmmaker what they want. Let them do it. And if they fail, fine. But at least they've had the instruments and everything else to make the film they wanted to make. And Cronenberg is the classic example of that, that you give him stuff and he makes a movie that people will talk about. People will talk about Crimes of the Future. People are still talking about The Fly and Scanners and Videodrome. You know, this is the thing. Crimes of the Future, while I'm not saying it's as good as those movies, it's got something to say, and I think that's great.
Nice. So you enjoyed it, but you wouldn't necessarily book in to see Sol Denser in a clinic.
I genuinely wouldn't, to be honest with you. No. You know, having watched it, I'm like, this is the type of person I would stay well away from. As I said, he's an eerie figure, a really eerie figure.
Cool. So where's this out?
So this is in cinemas now. So you can, you can visualize it on the biggest screens possible, basically.
Early shout for a Halloween warm-up.
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
Nice. Excellent. What you got for us next week, Mark?
So next week, we're going to be talking about Clerks 3. Kevin Smith has finally made the end part of his trilogy for Clerks and Clerks 2.
Nice.
Started all the way back in the 90s. We're going to be talking about a British movie set in the Outer Hebrides called The Road Dance. And then as a podcast special, we're going to be talking about a bizarre movie called Strawberry Mansion. It's going to take quite some clever talking from me to try and explain this movie, but that's next week. So I've got a week to prep
to
for
prepare
it.
Prepare your words.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yes. Yes. So those will be coming next week.
Excellent. I look forward to it, Mark. I shall see you there with a pan of strawberries.
Will do.
Film reviews and movie news with Stuart Pink and Mark Searby.
Thanks for listening to Film Reviews and Movie News. We've been doing this little podcast for years now. Mark has watched and expertly reviewed hundreds of films, and I've made hundreds of terrible jokes. They're all available to listen to again if you subscribe to the Film Reviews and Movie News podcast. It's freely available wherever you get your podcasts from, or you can find all the latest episodes and everything else I do online at stuartpink.com.